The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
There are some people who call Dr. Mona a whistleblower. There are others of us who call her a truth teller. And that is the reason I am so delighted this evening to have an opportunity to welcome to my city of Philadelphia, and to introduce to you to my friend, Dr. Mona. Doctor?
Hello, hello.
Hello, thank you. Thank you for that awesome introduction, Ralph. Thank you. It is great to see everybody. Thank you for braving the torrential storm. I know a lot of you probably have some wet feet. My feet are a little squishy and soggy as well. But it is great to be here. It's great to be in Philadelphia. And it's great to be with all of you. So we are going to spend about a half an hour. I'll just be sharing a little bit about the book. Then we'll open it up to questions and answers, which are awesome. And that's usually the best part of these discussions. And then hopefully I'll get a chance to meet you all out back for a book signing. So let me start kind of with what happened. And by and large, most of you know what happened. So is anybody from Michigan? Do we have a Michigan group? Whoa, my gosh, that's amazing. Okay, so Michiganders, show me kind of where you're from in our state. How do we do that? Awesome, so look around for the people who are not from Michigan. So you see how everybody's putting out their hand? So Michigan is the mitten state, and show me more where you're from. We're gonna try to guess your cities. So like Grand Rapids, awesome. Detroit area, from Holland, Detroit. Awesome. So we have Metro Flint, maybe? Flint, awesome. So we actually have two hands because we also have the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, but we forget about them. So it's really like this, but we often forget about the Upper Peninsula. So this is Michigan, right? So why are we the Mitten State? What are we surrounded by? Water, the Great Lakes, right? So we are surrounded by the largest source of fresh water in the world. The Great Lakes is 20% of the fresh water, the largest source of fresh water in the world, and here's Flint. So literally in the middle of the largest source of fresh water in the world, and to this day, the people of Flint, a predominantly poor and minority community, still are drinking bottled water and filtered water. So let that sit in for a while. So how did this start? So before the water crisis, what was Flint famous for? Cars! Awesome, you guys are great. You didn't know this was going to be audience participation. So Flint was famous for cars. So General Motors was born in Flint. And even more importantly than the birthplace of cars, and you get extra credit if you know this, what was Flint famous for that was related to the birth of cars? AC, that's a kind of a GM spinoff, Spartan. Unions, who said that? Awesome. So even more importantly than being the birthplace of cars, Flint is literally the birthplace of the middle class in America. In the 1930s, Flint workers said, we want a share of this prosperity. We want occupational health and safety. We want better wages. We want benefits. And they literally sat down and did something illegal in the car plants. They sat down and occupied a series of car plants. It was called the historic sit-down strikes in the 1936-1937 cold Michigan winter. And there's amazing stories of women, of the wives that got involved, and not just baking cookies and bringing coffee, but literally getting beat by police officers and fighting for these jobs. And for 44 days, these workers committed a sheer act of disobedience. And they were brave, and they were resilient. And finally, it took the personal intervention of the governor of Michigan at the time and President Roosevelt to end that strike and recognize their union, and the UAW was born. So the governor of Michigan at that time was my favorite Michigan governor, unlike some of the current ones, and his name was Frank Murphy. So Frank Murphy was an amazing progressive. He went on to become a Supreme Court justice, and he was the dissenting opinion in the Korematsu case. Who knows what the Korematsu case is? Oh, you guys are so smart. So the Korematsu case was about the internment of Japanese Americans, and he was the first person to use the word racism in the Supreme Court. So he was an amazing, amazing progressive who stood up for the people of Flint, who stood up for the workers and refused to use force to end that strike. And the UAW was born, labor was born, and what happened in Flint back in that day was something called the Grand Bargain. What it happened there informed wages across the country for decades. And it's so hard to believe that at one point, Flint had the highest per capita income in the country. Can you believe that? The people of Flint made the most money in the entire country. And because of that, we had some of the best public health indices, great infrastructure, great schools, great systems. And Flint was a place where people moved to. Immigrants from all over the country came to Flint. The Great Migration North, African Americans fleeing Jim Crow, came to Flint for that American dream. The very first subdivision in America was in Flint. So the middle class was also born in Flint because of the resilience and disobedience of regular people. So then what happened after all this? Something else that Flint is famous for. Geniuses, deindustrialization. So a lot of people say Michael Moore, Roger and me. So Michael Moore is from Flint. So we lost those amazing, great high wage union jobs because of deindustrialization, because of lack of imagination, because of automation, for many different reasons. And Flint has literally been in crisis for decades. Decades of crisis due to that disinvestment, that unemployment, racism, poverty. We have a 60% poverty rate for our children. 60. One of the highest violent crime rates in the country. One of the highest poverty rates in the country. Every disparity you can imagine we have in Flint, even before the water crisis. So much so that all of this adversity impacts our children in a very graded and predictable fashion. A child born in Flint literally has a 15-year less life expectancy than a child in a neighboring adjacent zip code. 15 years. And this is not unique to Flint. There are communities all across the nation where you can draw subway maps where, based on the zip code of your birth, it predicts your entire life course trajectory, and that is absolutely not right. So Flint was in this dire state, and in Michigan, if you are in near bankruptcy, the state can swoop in and fix things. So the state in 2011 came in and took over the city. We became under control of state-appointed emergency management. And that emergency manager's job was one thing. It was austerity. It was, how do we save money, save money, save money? No regard for public health and no regard for children's health. And the emergency manager was a grossly undemocratic process. In 2013, half of African Americans in our state were under emergency management, compared to only 2% of our white population. Grossly, grossly undemocratic. So the emergency manager decided that the water that we had been getting from the Great Lakes, remember, surrounded by the Great Lakes, so the water that we had been getting from the Great Lakes was too expensive for this predominantly poor and minority community, and that we would start drawing water from the local Flint River until a new pipeline was to be built to the Great Lakes. So the move to the Flint River was temporary. It wasn't supposed to be permanent. And then we would reconnect to a different pipeline to the Great Lakes. So in April of 2014, literally with a very simple flip of a switch, the mayor went on TV, flipped the switch, drank a glass of water. We went on to the Flint River water. And the people of Flint throughout this crisis have been and continue to be heroic. They knew something was wrong, and they raised their voices. Their water was brownish and greenish, and it tasted weird, and it looked weird. It smelled weird. We had bacteria in the water, and then there was a lot of boil advisories to get rid of the bacteria, which is actually the worst thing that you can do for lead in water because it concentrates whatever you're cooking and whatever you're boiling. Then a lot of chlorine was added to kill bacteria, but that irritated people's skin and eyes, and people felt that they were drinking out of a swimming pool. We had so much chlorine added that we had a buildup of something called disinfectant byproducts, total trihalomethanes, TTHMs. You can't even say it. And it's a long-term carcinogen. It causes cancers. We had cancer. We had 9 months of safe drinking water violations because of a buildup of these disinfectant byproducts. But after every red flag, the city, the state said everything was okay, that everything is in compliance, that the people of Flint can literally relax, that there is nothing wrong. One of the earliest red flags, which should have ended the crisis never should have began, but one of the earliest red flags was when General Motors, born in Flint, right, still operates plants in Flint, stopped using this water just a few months after the water switch because it was corroding their engine parts. Think about that. Our water was corroding engine parts, and they got a pass to go back to Great Lakes water. But the people of Flint were told to relax. I mean, it didn't. The red alarm bell should have gone off on people's heads. It's corroding engine parts. What is it doing to our infrastructure underground, which is predominantly lead-based? So many, many, many red flags throughout this crisis. So it turns out that the Flint River water was 19 times more corrosive than the water we had been getting from Detroit for several reasons. River water is innately more corrosive than lake water. But the biggest problem is that the water wasn't being treated properly. It was missing an important ingredient called corrosion control. To me, as a doctor, I think of it like a medicine that you put in the water to prevent whatever's in the pipes from coming out of the pipes and into the drinking water. So that more corrosive water wasn't being treated. It was going into an aging distribution system. So we have lead in all of our plumbing. So I didn't even know this before this crisis. So where's any young high school students, chemistry? Go back to high school chemistry. What's the elemental symbol for lead? PB. So PB comes from the Latin plumbum, which means plumbing. So lead actually means plumbing. When the Romans built their aqueducts, they used lead plumbing. There's actually theories that hypothesize the demise of the Romans was because they used so much lead in their plumbing, but they also put a lead in their food, and it was bad ideas. So lead has always meant plumbing. We were stubbornly slow as a nation to restrict lead in all of our plumbing. The lead industry was very, very strong. There's a lot of that history in the book, and it's page-turning history. It's not boring history, it's gripping history. So Oprah put this book on her summer reading list, and she called it like a Grisham-like novel. So it's amazing, fascinating, you know, history. And the science is also page-turning. It really is, okay? So we were stubbornly slow as a nation to restrict the use of lead in our plumbing. Not until 1986 did we restrict it in our service lines, which are the lines that go from the water main to someone's house. But get this, not until 2014 did we restrict lead from brass fixtures. So Flint schools had some of the highest water lead levels. They didn't have lead pipes, but it was the lead that was in the fixtures and the faucets and the solder that was corroding and leaching the lead out. So this more corrosive water that wasn't being treated properly was going into a distribution system that had a lot of lead in it, and that created this perfect storm for the lead to come out of our plumbing, into our water, and ultimately into the bodies of our children. So as the book details, this was happening for 18 months. And I was going about my busy world, my busy life as a pediatrician, as a medical educator, as a mom, as a wife, hearing vaguely concerns about the water and activists and bacteria and all this stuff. But I was being reassured because the state said everything was okay. I mean, like, it's America, right? We're the richest country in the history of the world. It's the 21st century. It's not 19th century London with, you know, cholera epidemics. It's, this the middle of the Great Lakes. But by and large, there's rules and there's regulations and there's people whose only job is to make sure that the water that comes out of our tap is okay. So I was drinking the Kool-Aid. So I literally thought everything was okay. until an evening at my home with a high school girlfriend. So high school girlfriend comes over, our kids were playing together, and my high school friend, out of all things, happens to be a drinking water expert. Like, try to find lots of diverse friends. Having a glass of wine, because all good stories start with wine, not salad. So, you know, main lesson is connect with friends. And my high school friend used to work at the EPA. She used to work at the EPA a decade ago when Washington, D.C. had a very similar lead and water crisis, and she was there at that time. Flint is absolutely not the first time. And she's like, Mona, I saw a memo from a former colleague that Flint's not treating their water properly. I'm like, yeah, so everything's okay. She's like, well, they're not doing something. They're not using corrosion control. And her eyes just kind of bore into my eyes. I'm like, I don't know what you're talking about. And she's like, well, without corrosion control, there's going to be lead in the water. And I just froze. When a pediatrician, when anybody in public health hears the word lead, we kind of freak out. We know what lead does. We've learned so much more about lead in the last few decades. It's a potent, irreversible neurotoxin. It impacts really the entire trajectory of a child, their cognition, their behavior. It's a form of environmental injustice already, a form of environmental racism. Already our kids in Flint and Detroit and Chicago and Philadelphia and DC and Baltimore, some of our country's most vulnerable children are already burdened with higher rates of lead than other kids. So when I heard about that possibility of lead being in the water, and to be honest, before that moment, I didn't even know there was lead in plumbing. There was no going back. There was only going forward to see if that was getting into the bodies of our children. And the book really kind of lays out what happened next, the research, the pushback, because just like everybody else in the story, that my science and was discredited and denied, just like the moms and the activists and the journalists and the water experts, everybody in the story was dismissed and denied. And when I brought up evidence, we were also attacked. But ultimately, we fought back. As a pediatrician, I literally took an oath to protect children. I literally took an oath to stand up and to be their voice and to be their advocate. That is and has been and continues to be my very professional obligation. But I would challenge you that we all took an oath. We all have an oath as citizens. It is our civic responsibility, our very deep obligation as humans, to stand up and protect children when we see especially injustices. So the book is so much more than just about Flint. So the book is called What the Eyes Don't See. And what that means is quite literally we do not see lead in water. It's invisible, it's colorless, it's odorless, it's tasteless. The color in Flint was because of iron corrosion, that was the rust. So we don't see lead in water. We also do not see the impact of lead. Lead is known as a silent pediatric epidemic. Children don't present to the clinic in acute intoxication or, you know, with acute symptoms. It's something that impacts populations, and it takes years, if not decades, to present. And when it does present, it's almost impossible to prove causation. But part of the title, What the Eyes Don't See, is also about people, it is about problems, and it is about places that we choose not to see. So many people were ignoring Flint, just like we ignore so many problems in our own communities. And the book is a rallying cry to remind all of us to open our eyes, to open each other's eyes to these problems. And it is important for us to be awake, but it is more important for us to act. So this book very much is about the crisis. It is so much more about the activism and the resistance and how we go about creating change in our communities. And the book is also very much about hope. So I want you to go away after reading this book, not thinking Flint equals disaster, but very much Flint equals a model of recovery. We are doing things in Flint right now that aren't being done anywhere else. And that's why I'm here for the Campaign for Grade Level Reading, to share some of our early literacy work. From the moment that we realized that we had this population-wide crisis, which was not just about lead, it was an entire trauma. We had one of the largest outbreaks of Legionnaires' disease where people died. We had skin issues. It extends far beyond lead. But from the moment that we recognized that we had this crisis, our commitment was tomorrow. It was what is going to happen to these children 5, 10, 15, 20 years from now. And it was protecting the potential of these children. So Flint is a story where common sense science was denied. Ultimately, it was our science that spoke truth to power. And we are very much leaning on the incredible science of child development and toxic stress and resilience to mitigate the impact of this crisis and to share our best practices. So what we hope to do in Flint, we hope to share. We hope to inform other communities because this book and this story is not isolated to Flint because we have kids everywhere who are waking up to very similar toxicities, be it from lead, be it from poverty, injustice, lost democracy, racism, unemployment, incarcerated parents, violence exposure, lack of nutrition, unsafe places to play, you name it. These are all toxicities, and they impact children in a very predictable way. So it is our responsibility as part of the society to make a difference and to mitigate those things for all children, and that's absolutely one of the lessons that we hope to share. So this book is a memoir. So this book is very much kind of a fast-paced telling of the uncovering of the water crisis, but it is also through my lens. Ralph mentioned that I'm not from here, so I am an immigrant. You know, it used to not be a bad word. I'll show you my birth certificate. So we came to this country when I was 4. I'm Iraqi American. We came fleeing the dictatorship and the tyranny and the fascism of Saddam Hussein. We came to this country, me and my family, for freedom, for opportunity, for democracy, and for that American dream. And that was absolutely realized for me and my family. And it is through that lens that, as an immigrant, that I wake up every day grateful and fortunate and lucky to be in this country. But it is also through that lens that I am very acutely aware of what injustice is and can be, of what people in power can do to vulnerable populations. As a child, my parents never shielded us from what was happening back home. And I clearly recall the first time I saw a dead baby. My father was showing me a picture. I was about 11 or 12 years old. And my father showed me a picture of the Halabja massacre. Anybody remember that? So this is when Saddam Hussein literally poisoned his own people in northern Iraq, a Kurdish town. It is to this day the largest chemical weapons attack. 5,000 people died. And I remember seeing this beautiful, fat baby girl wrapped in a pink blanket, held by her father, and both of them dead on the street. And that is the milieu of my childhood, very much knowing and recognizing what injustice could be. And it's through that lens that I do my work, that I see the world, that I've pledged really my career to be in communities and to always have my eyes open for injustices. So this book is a mix of a lot of things. There's Arabic food and there's Arabic words and there's science history and Flint history and labor history. So it's a blend of a lot of interwoven pieces that are part of the story and part of me. And I don't think that immigrant story would have been as big a part of this book if not for the last presidential election, because literally, like, I am that kid that is at the border who is no longer allowed entry into this country. Lady Liberty opened her arms and we were welcomed here. And because of that, I grew up confident and competent and proud of my diversity, even though, like, nobody knew what homeless was as a kid. Thank you. Thank you. So you got to wonder what we're going to miss out on because of our current political climate and why we all need to raise our voices and be activists and be disobedient and be resistors and work to improve the lives of children. Thank you, guys. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. So at this time, we will take questions, and we have this lovely gentleman who has a microphone who will come to you if you raise your hand.
What are you doing with kids?
Great
little
question.
Kids in schools.
So what are we doing with children? I'm so glad you asked that. We are doing a lot. So we, we're leaning on the, I think the most important thing in pediatrics and public health is this recognition of toxic stress and adverse child experiences, that what happens in early childhood, you know, impacts you for really your whole life. So we are really taking advantage of that critical period of brain plasticity between this kind of prenatal to preschool period to limit, to mitigate, to buffer the impact of not only this toxicity, but the toxicity that our children already had in Flint. So we are building resilience through interventions that are known to promote children's development. So what are those? So for example, we've doubled the capacity of our home visiting programs, things like nurse family partnership, maternal infant health program. Yeah, we got some home visitors. So huge expansion of home visiting. We have two brand new child care centers. One is an Educare center, which is like one of the highest quality child care centers that now serve over 500 kids that provide high quality year-round free child care. This is at the most critical 0 to 5 period of brain development. It's also a known poverty mitigator. I remember when my kids got out of preschool, it was like getting a raise. And this is free high quality child care. We have a massive expansion in early literacy. So you guys know these stats. So in places like Flint, there's one book for every 300 kids. By the time our children reach the age of 3, they've heard 30 million less words. By the time they reach 18 months, you see evidence of that achievement gap. By kindergarten, it is almost impossible to bridge that gap. So we have made massive investments around early literacy. We're part of the Imagination Library program. Every kid in Flint gets a book mailed to them every month from the age of 0 to 5. 4,000 kids are already in that program. Awesome. We've expanded another evidence-based literacy program called Reach Out and Read, which is a clinic-based program. We went from 1 clinic to 10 clinics that now do that. We have this is great. You guys are awesome. You must all be from the literacy world. We've created a program called Born to Read. Babies at the hospital get a bundle of books, developmental tools, and get signed up for these programs. We are also addressing 2-generation and 3-generation literacy. We have pop-up preschools and other things that to help with parents and grandparents with just around literacy. School nurses. I know there's some school nurses. Yay, school nurses are awesome. So in Flint, before this crisis, we had 1 school nurse. One school nurse. It was in our very first ask to the state was to expand school nurses. We now have over 10 school nurses. And we also have some new school-based health centers. So we work very close. I mean, there's no better friend to a pediatrician than those in the education community. It's all about the potential of our children. So school nurses, mindfulness. Our kids in Flint schools do mindfulness programming. Up to 3 times a day, they do like yoga and meditation. Yeah, we've got some mindfulness fans in the audience. We expanded Medicaid. This was the biggest gift from the federal government, was expanded Medicaid. Medicaid is awesome. And it increased the age and the income eligibility of Medicaid. We have no grocery stores in Flint, so we actually have mobile grocery stores. We give out nutrition prescriptions. My clinic, which sees the most Flint kids, is actually located on the second floor of a farmer's market. It is the only clinic of its kind, but that is on purpose. That's it's for us to address the environmental burdens that our families face. So I used to tell my patients, oh, you need to eat avocado and kale, and they would just stare at me like, where am I going to get avocado and kale? So we made the conscious decision to put our clinic where patients can get fresh fruits and vegetables to address that nutrition insecurity, and every kid that comes to clinic, be it for an ear infection or a cold or a well baby visit, gets a prescription that they fill downstairs for fruits and veggies. We also have cooking classes for kids and families. Mobile grocery stores, and the list can goes on and on and on of what we've been able to put in place. So right when the crisis hit, we were struck by the generosity of the nation. Everybody came to bring us bottled water, and we were so grateful. Like when a crisis happens in a nation, it kind of reaffirms the goodness of humanity because people give and people help. Like Boy Scouts in Indiana and like a ballroom dance group in Kentucky, people brought water. We had so much water was being stored in an Air Force base. Like it was amazing. But very quickly we realized, soon we will be past the point of needing water. We'll be needing to fund the breastfeeding programs and the playgrounds and the litter. literacy work and the nutrition education. So we created something called the Flint Kids Fund, flintkids.org, which is one of the reasons I wrote this book, because part of the proceeds go to that Flint Kids fund to fund all of these evidence-based development promoting interventions for years to come. So when you buy this book, it's a win-win because it also also helps the kids.
Is there anyone looking into the water supplies of the other cities in the United States now and going forward?
That is a great question. So it was about, like, what's up with water everywhere? Like, are we looking at that everywhere? And that's been one of the really amazing positive ripple effects from the Flint water crisis, is that people are paying attention again to lead. They thought lead was a problem of yesterday. Oh, we got rid of lead from gas and paint. Yeah, it's getting better, but really it's a problem of today and tomorrow. But also the issue of water quality. So in the last few years, I have learned so much about the regulations that protect our water. And they are grossly inadequate. We were never, as a nation, meant to get lead-free water. The lead and copper rule, which is part of the Safe Drinking Water Act, has not been updated in a very long time. The action levels have nothing to do with health or science. They're all about feasibility of water systems. So people are talking about this. There's advocacy now, and there's legislation to try to get these things strengthened. Not much happening at the EPA right now, but things are happening at state levels. Michigan, just this last month, passed a lead and copper rule that exceeds federal standards. Other cities are taking action. Flint is still on filtered and bottled water because we're finally replacing our lead pipes. We will only be the third city in the country that has replaced their lead pipes. The two other cities are Lansing, Michigan, and Madison, Wisconsin. But other cities are now talking about it, how they need to invest in the infrastructure that is underground. We think our roads and our bridges are bad. What's underneath is out of sight, what our eyes don't see. It's probably even worse. And the lead in the plumbing is a big problem, especially in the Northeast and the Midwest. So the GAO, the Government Accountability Office, put out a report last week, a national report looking at lead in water in schools. So this is also a Flint ripple effect, and saying that, hey, schools are testing everywhere and they are finding lead everywhere because it's there. So it's great. It's a lot of advocacy and education that's happening around the country because of this. But there's a lot more work that needs to be done.
Hi, I'm a school nurse in Delaware.
Woohoo, school nurses!
I have two questions. One, I feel like I know your family personally. I hope everybody's doing well.
Everybody's good. You must have read the book.
I did. I listened to it.
Oh, I recorded the audio book. Yeah.
It's great. Thank you. Also, is somebody following the data post the book?
Great. So the question was, is somebody following the data? And we were just funded by the CDC to build a Flint registry. This very much modeled after the World Trade Center registry and big exposure-based registries. But the point of our registry is not research. It's not long-term monitoring. It is to get people connected to all this awesomeness that we have brought in so that we do not see the consequences. So the registry is identifying those who are exposed, getting them connected to those mitigating services, and then following them long-term to see how they are doing. So yes, in my very kind of academic hat, we hope in a very data-driven way to share our outcomes.
Yes, thank you for being here. We're really excited, and I agree with Denise that I feel like I know you after reading your book and enjoying it. But I have a question about, after reading this, I started worrying about the lead in our water. And how do we get that tested? Is there a kit that you can buy, or do you have to bring in someone?
So I was on the radio earlier today, WHYY, with the Philadelphia Water Commissioner, and she said that anybody can call in Philadelphia, and they will come and check your water, which is great. But just so that you know, water testing is very variable. You can test your water 10 different times and get 10 different results. It's dependent on time of day. It's dependent on season. It's worse in the summer than in the fall. It's dependent on how you collect, if you pre-flush, the size of the bottle. So there's a lot of nuances with testing. And many places, especially schools, are doing testing, but some of these places are just automatically going to a filter-first philosophy, especially if they know that it's an older building with lead in that infrastructure. And we worry the most about the youngest children. Lead impacts everyone, but it's the kids who are the most vulnerable to this. So if there's a pregnant mom, if there's a baby, especially who's using this water to mix their formula, then I would recommend filtered water. especially for the most vulnerable, the youngest. And I just want to say that it's so amazing to be in Pennsylvania, because this is the home of one of the original lead fighters. Does anybody know who I'm talking about? Ralphie probably not. So a pediatrician, Herb Needleman. So Herb Needleman trained in CHOP. That's where he did his residency, but he spent most of his life in Pittsburgh. And he is really a pediatrician who fought and fought and fought and was attacked and attacked and attacked by the lead industry for years because of his advocacy for children. So it's really special to be here. He recently passed away, I think about a year or two. But it was in your state that we know a lot of the science of the evilness of lead.
I have two questions, nothing to do with science. I'm coming from a political standpoint. I'm concerned that Democrats and Republicans are not sufficiently different than they once were. So have you seen the Democratic Party doing anything to stand out, or have they been part of the serious problems in Flint? Second question, there was an opportunity, I think, to link the races, because we too often segregate. We think of poor, we think of naturally African Americans. What about the poor whites? Could you bring them into this picture? Is there solidarity, so to speak? Are people working together across race lines?
Sure, absolutely. So Flint is, we'll do your second question first. So Flint is 58% African American. So we do have a very large Caucasian population. We have a tiny Hispanic population. Here's another quiz, a random point. What do you guys think the most common second language in Flint is? Total trick question. It's actually sign language. We have a very large deaf community, and the School for the Deaf for the state of Michigan is located in Flint, which created a lot of challenges to get the message across. So actually in all of our press conferences, et cetera, we actually have a sign language interpreter. Okay, I digress. So you read the book, so the activists, the folks, you know, on the ground were all kinds of folks. It didn't matter, you know, if you were black or white or what have you. People were working together and to raise the alarm. So a lot of people, when they think Flint, they think predominantly African American. It is the eighth largest majority minority city in the country, but we have all kinds of folks who literally did come together. And I think that's one of the lessons of this story, by and large, not specifically just about race, but about folks who came together. The story is absolutely not about me. It is about a team. It is about a team of folks who came together, a team of people who could not be more different in terms of professions, gender, race, backgrounds. And so often we live in our own little bubbles and we think that nobody else is fighting our fight or cares about things as much as we do. And that kind of gets a little bit to the politics. But in this story, like, my best friend was a water engineer from Virginia who couldn't have been more different than me. But I think he cared more about kids than I did. And I thought pediatricians had a monopoly on caring for children. So I think, you know, one of the big lessons from the story is to find your village, is to get out of your comfort zones, to get out of your boxes, to get out of your networks, and to find the folks that are part of your village. In terms of the politics, in terms of Democrats and Republicans, this story is also the story of the amazing work of our elected public servants. Our state senator, our two U.S. senators, our U.S. congressmen were absolute fighters for Flint. And that's highlighted in the book. But really the only way that we were able to move past kind of bipartisanship was when we started to involve folks from the other side of the aisle. So I met with one of our Republican congressmen from the west side of the state. He didn't really know much about the story. I was in D.C. I visited him in his office. I shared what was happening. I shared the science in my kind of pediatrician hat and what we needed to do next. And eventually he became a co-sponsor for the Flint bill that passed Congress. So we can't be preaching to the choir. We have to work as much as possible in a bipartisan manner. People are like, you know, how do you talk to the current administration? And don't, you know, some of these folks should be in jail. Like, how are you working with them? And there is no partisanship in my work as a pediatrician. My constituency is children. And I will work with whomever, whenever, and really the next five administrations to advocate on behalf of kids. So that's sometimes difficult to separate because you're like, want to scream sometimes. but you know, I think when you retain as more credibility as possible if you can keep that hat on.
Hi, Hedy.
Simona, one of the things I'm always struck by is the power of a pediatrician to call attention. Not that you weren't part of a team, but there is something of the position that a pediatrician has as a trusted agent for families and a community. What have you learned from your work about what we need to teach the next generation of pediatricians?
That's a great question. So Hedy asked about the role of a pediatrician being a trusted, credible voice in the community. And it never should have gotten, the Flint story never should have gotten to the point where you needed a pediatrician to share evidence that children had lead in their blood. It never should have gotten there. It should have stopped when that first mom raised the jug of brown water and said, "I'm worried about my kids." Pediatrics 101 is moms are always right. I mean, like, why weren't they being listened to? But ultimately, you know, it was this amazing team and very much the loud, stubborn voice of a pediatrician who helped elevate this issue. And my when I talk to medical students and when I talk to pediatric residents in training, I remind them of the incredible privilege that they have in their community that they so often have forgotten about. We go into medicine, we go into this profession because we want to help people. And studies show that as folks progress through their medical training, they become more jaded, they get more focused on billing and coding and revenue and ICD-10 and electronic medical records, and they forget why they went into medicine, which is to help, which is to serve. It is a privilege. I wake up every day lucky and blessed to be able to do this work. So kind of my role in this crisis and what I've tried to, you know, use with this microphone is to remind doctors that you have this privileged and very special role in your community, and you have to continue working hand in hand with your community partners, not do this, but in partnership to elevate voices when voices are especially being dismissed and denied. But like I said, it never should have gotten to my voice, needing to raise that alarm. But it is a reminder that physicians do have power, and they need to increasingly use their power. I was part of the National March for Science, which was a movement to get doctors and academics and teachers and professors out of their environments, out of their classrooms and clinics and, you know, ivory towers, and into the community to use their science, to share their messages, because so often we're so cozy in our little spaces that we, you know, we're isolated to what's happening outside of us. But we need to work more with our community.
I want to get back to the politics of water a bit here. In my suburban community, the water company, which was owned by the county government, I guess, or perhaps the municipal governments, was sold to a private firm.
Privatization of a public good.
Right. And so I'm very concerned about how we can get back to thinking that this is an important function of government to provide clean water and take away the waste. And your thoughts on
that? I completely agree with you. The foundation of modern societies is built on access to safe drinking water. I go into that in the book as well. So, you know, this fits into this trend of austerity and privatization, and that big government, all government is bad, so let's kind of emasculate government and privatize our schools and privatize our water utility and privatize the postal service. So this is not what government is for. If we cannot trust that our government can protect our public welfare and our public goods, and not just for privileged folks, but for all folks, you know, what do we have left as a society, as a civilization, as a people? So it's a dangerous trend and is only increasing, and I think we have to continue to speak up about it.
Yeah, you've talked a lot about tap water coming through the taps. What, if any, assurances do we have about bottled water?
That's a great question, as I am guzzling this bottled water. So bottled water is governed by the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration, not the EPA. Specifically just about lead in bottled water, the action level for lead in bottled water is set at 5 parts per billion, whereas at the EPA it's set at 15 parts per billion. So just for lead, it is supposedly safer, but it's not like they test every bottled water, it's batch tested. There's also, I've learned, so many different kinds of bottled water. There's some that are purified, some by reverse osmosis, some are spring water. Spring water doesn't actually often have disinfectant, so if it's left out in the sun, you know, it can have bacteria overgrowth. So, and then there's plastic, and what about the plastic getting in? So there's risks to everything. Because of the Flint water crisis last year, bottled water actually outsold soda in this nation because of what was happening in Flint. But it's not a good thing either. We should be able to trust our tap.
Hi.
Hi.
The screening, is there any changes in the lead screening for the population in Flint and across the country? Has that changed or is it going to?
I'm so glad that you asked that. She asked about lead screening, and I assume you were talking about blood lead screening, and this gives me a great opportunity to share that we should not be screening children. We are using children and continue to use children as detectors of environmental problems. They are literally the canaries in the coal mine. That is not because once we find lead in a child, it just tells us there's an environmental problem, but there's not much we can do for that kid. So we need to be more proactive. We need to screen environments, and that's happening. Massachusetts, before you buy a house, they literally check the water and the soil and the dust for lead before a family moves in. And there's some innovative programs, including in Flint, where we are screening the environment of children before we are screening children. So that is something that we all need. So home visitors should think about screening environments before a mom gets pregnant. And there's many other innovative things that are happening before we detect it in children because it is too late. In regards to the screening of children, so back in the day, like, well, gosh, 15 years ago or so, the CDC recommended that universal screening, that all children get tested for lead at the ages of 1 and 2, because at the ages of 1 and 2, that's when a child is crawling, walking, has a lot of hand-to-mouth activity, and is developmentally at risk for household lead exposure, like dust and soil and paint. When lead levels came down significantly over the last 3 decades, those recommendations relaxed, and now it's only for high-risk populations, like kids on Medicaid, because that's a proxy for poverty, or kids with older homes. And because that recommendation relaxed, doctors don't do it. We're really bad at following directions. Like, if it's not, like, universal, like, it's really hard for us to think and do that. So, and some states still mandate universal testing, but those rates are still not great. But the universal testing is, like I said, it's not the answer. Lead in blood has a very short detection window. It has something called a half-life of 28 days. So it's also not foolproof. So we really need to be focusing our efforts and our investments in finding it in the environment and eliminating it before children are exposed.
More importantly, what we want to hear is, how do we stand up to power? And say,
it's in the book.
No, I know it's in the book, but I don't know if my students have read the book yet. But the point is, the takeaway message is, we live in a democracy.
Yeah.
We vote those policymakers in office. They report to us, and yet
yes.
They don't get swept under the bus. We do.
Yeah. Vote. Vote. You said it. It's vote, 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 vote. Work on campaigns. Give money to campaigns. Hold people accountable. Meet with your legislators. Build a team of people around you. Build that vigil, that village. But it's all about being civically engaged. Write letters. Do what we should be doing anyways. But ultimately, in this next election, you need to vote. You need to bring your whole block to the polling site. Absolutely.
So we seem to be at a critical moment in our democracy where we're all asking ourselves, can we trust our elected officials? And what happened in Flint was an incredible breach of trust between the people and the folks who were supposed to be taking care of things, right? Are you starting to see some return of that trusting relationship back and forth? And how do you rebuild after such a traumatic breach of trust?
That's a great question. So the question was about trust, and that's going to take a very long time to come back. And I discuss this in a book. I talk about a truth and reconciliation process in Flint. And right now, there are a lot of efforts at accountability. Actually, just today, there was another hearing against our state health director, who's charged with negligent homicide because of the Legionella deaths. That those efforts at accountability, at getting at the truth, are critically important. Then there is a role for restorative justice and reparations. And then we can really continue on to that path of recovery, which will take time. Last week, I spoke at a conference of philosophers, which was really easy. We were strange, very strange to speak to a bunch of philosophers who were very pensive. Anyways, the philosophers, so somebody asked that trust question, and I gave a similar response, and she's like, well, don't you think it's good to not have trust? Shouldn't we all have a little bit of mistrust so that we can continue to question authority, so that we can push back on things that our gut is telling us is not right? So I think that's there's validity there too. So, you know, and Flint is a place, like I said before, trust had been shattered for a long time. It was a city that was neglected for quite a bit of time before this water crisis from both institutional, governmental, political processes. So it's going to take a long time to come back, but I also think a healthy dose of mistrust is important for all of us.
Hi, I'm wondering if you had noticed a difference, like an uptick in certain symptoms in Flint residents over others. And secondly, you had also mentioned the difficulty in proving causation in a case like this. What evidence out there is there that it's due to the switch in the water? Or what are people working on now to prove that?
Sure. So the evidence was the biggest evidence. The most important evidence was the lead in the water, which was transparently shared. And there's been many publications about the lead in water levels. And that was done with citizen science. That was done hand in hand with citizens to collect water lead specimens. And then after the emergency, it was done by the EPA in our state. And we had lead in water levels through the roof in the hundreds and thousands of parts per billion. We had a home with a lead in water level of 22,000 parts per billion. But every ward, every part of the city, every school had elevated levels of lead in water, and you can see the multiple publications about that. The blood lead levels, our research was, even though it was initially publicly shared, it was eventually published in a peer review process that also showed the elevation in the percentage of children's lead levels that correlated with where the water lead levels were the highest. So in the neighborhoods, the census blocks where the water levels were the highest was where we saw the greatest increase in children's lead levels, and nothing was happening around the outside of the city that did not change its water source. That work, that research was also validated by the CDC in one of their publications. The Legionella evidence has also been, there's about four articles that have also associated the Legionella deaths with the water source change and this corrosive water. So the evidence in terms of what's going to happen in the future and how to prove causation is very difficult. All the work in lead and lead exposure is based on the field of epidemiology, which is big population health data. And we are building that registry, which is all about that big data, that big population data. Our biggest focus is to look at the impact of the services that we brought in. Like, because this kid got Head Start and home visiting and school nurses and WIC, you know, this is how they turned up versus these other children. So we are going to have some of that big data ability to do that stuff. We also have some smaller research projects that are looking at more kind of scientific things. For example, baby teeth are really good ways to look at past lead exposure. Dr. Needleman, I was actually called a tooth fairy because he collected children's teeth in Pittsburgh to look at how much lead was in their teeth. So we are doing some of that fancy science as well to look at past exposure.
Join me in thanking Dr. Mona.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.